Welcome to this podcast, brought to you by the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries Sustainability Board. Launched in 2015, the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals are a blueprint for peace and prosperity for people and planet. The 17 goals represent a rare agreement in international policy. Adopted by all United Nations member states, they are cross-cutting and wide-reaching, from no poverty and quality education to affordable clean energy and climate action. They recognise that strategies to end social deprivations go hand in hand with protecting our precious environment. In this series, we welcome expertise from a range of guests, both from within and outside of the actuarial profession, reflecting the collaboration required to achieve progress. We highlight the relevance of these goals to areas of actuarial practice, explore the opportunities for actuaries to step up, and showcase those already working towards this bold agenda. Hi, I'm Lucy Say and I'll be hosting today's episode. In this session, we are speaking to Dr. Ellen Quigley from Cambridge University on the topic of universal ownership. We're going to be finding out what it is, why the SDGs are topics that the universal owner should be interested in, and highlighting the relevance of universal ownership to actuarial practice. Ellen is the advisor to the Chief Financial Officer for Responsible Investment at the University of Cambridge, and a research associate in climate risk and sustainable finance at the Centre for the Study of Existential Risk. Ellen, thank you for joining me and welcome.
It's my pleasure, Lucy. Glad to be here.
So we met at the start of this year, back end of last year. I can't quite remember exactly when, but you came to speak to the Sustainability Board about universal ownership. And I work for a large insurance company. I'm a life actuary, so I have a very long-term focus. I'm used to thinking in the long term. And I also have my CIRA qualification. So I've touched on systemic risks, but it was really the first time I'd encountered universal ownership. So what I'd like is just if you could start by giving us an intro. What is a universal owner? What characteristics does a universal owner have?
Sure. Thanks, Lucy. So There's kind of the traditional definition of universal ownership, which really refers to very large, long-term asset owners like pension funds or sovereign wealth funds, university endowments, etc. Those with long-term investment horizons or liabilities, and that basically end up having to own a more or less representative slice of the economy as a whole, as opposed to kind of stock picking with large overweights in certain sectors. So basically they own a bit of everything, and therefore the externalities from one sector or one company end up adding costs to other companies that they own elsewhere in their portfolio. So basically you can't avoid externalities, you can't stock pick your way out of risks like climate change or pandemics, as we've unfortunately learned this year. So that's kind of the traditional idea. I would argue that this actually includes a lot larger group of beneficiaries. So basically anybody who has investments and is under the age of 60, I would argue, is a universal owner, because certainly a lot of people are already suffering from climate change, but 30 years from now, really, there won't be a part of the earth that is unaffected. Everyone will be affected, every company will be affected, every sector. I'd also argue that anyone who is invested passively, literally owns a representative slice of the economy, so they would be kind of automatic universal owners as well. So basically, it's a lot larger group than we think, and what it does is it allows you to think about systemic risks in the real world and whether you should be actually working with other universal owners to address them, as opposed to trying to kind of narrowly escape them yourselves, which might not really work.
And the other thing you touch on is the expansion of funds that are considered to be universal owners, and you highlight the rise of fiduciary capitalism, institutional ownership, and you've just mentioned passive investing. So could I just get you to explain the link there?
Right. So when we talk about passive investments, so we're talking about index funds or you know ETFs that that are basically just exposure to a whole index. And what that means is you really are just exposed to the whole financial system, which means that, you know, the discussion that we were just having about externalities means that you are going to pick up the costs in some part of your portfolio that are caused in another. And the rise of fiduciary capitalism just kind of describes this general trend that we've seen, wherein we have these very large funds and quite a lot of kind of common ownership of companies. And it is a situation in which we have institutional investors basically owning the largest companies in the market in such a way that actually they could be exercising control over how they behave, especially in terms of, say, emissions. So that's the idea.
And you're quite clear that climate change risks are manifesting themselves today. And it's not just something that we need to be thinking about as emerging in the medium or the long term, but actually in the short term too. And I wondered if you could just speak a bit about that, because it will be useful for actuaries who are thinking about the various timescales that they need to look at these risks.
Absolutely. I mean, so as with so many things, climate change is unfair. So it's already affecting most the countries and the people who had the least to do with causing climate change in the first place. So, you know, you've got a lot of flooding in, you know, small islands, small island nations. You've got and Bangladesh and other kind of low-lying nations like that that have fewer resources to combat that. And you also have a lot of you know, tropical storms that are disproportionately affecting poorer countries. But you're also seeing already extreme weather events and, you know, higher numbers of yet more extreme weather events that are kind of affecting everybody, or rather at least most communities that live along shorelines. So, you know, you get, you know, all these large scale hurricanes and tornadoes and so on and so forth. And, you know, a city like New York City gets hit by, you know, fairly frequent, very large and destructive storms. And even though that's a city that is, you know, has a lot of resources, there's still just an insane amount of damage that's being done every time there's a storm like that. And of course, these things compound themselves as well. I mean, you look at Puerto Rico and what they've gone through, you know, having one devastating storm was quite enough, but having a succession of them before the rebuilding had been completed from previous storms, I mean, it really does accumulate. So, you know, those, and then there are the fires. I mean, California and Australia are both high income places that have been really drastically affected by fires. And that's absolutely an actuarial issue as well. So we're already seeing this. It's just, the problem is it's going to increase dramatically and also unpredictably, right? We can't be sure of which geographies will be, you know, particularly affected by particular storms or fires, although we can make a good guess. So, you know, these things are already happening. They are going to get worse, though, unless we do something very, very swiftly and aggressively.
And you sort of touched on the unfairness angle, and I know your recent contribution to the universal ownership literature has been on inequality and it just expanding it for that. So perhaps we could touch on how inequality fits into that universal ownership framework.
Sure. Yeah, I'm really concerned about inequality, and for a number of reasons. One, I just think it's a moral issue, but I think even if you didn't think of it as a moral issue and didn't particularly care about it, it still has a bearing. So in a number of different ways. So first of all, you know, the OECD will tell you that we need a strong, prosperous middle class to have a level of financial stability and macroeconomic health that's required. You know, in countries with you know, wide gaps between the richest and the poorest. You have a whole bunch of other issues, both just purely economic, because the lower end has a higher propensity to consume, which means that the less they have to spend, the less you get circulation of, you know, money through the economy. You know, the very richest tend to save or put their money into already inflated assets. So you just don't see the kind of the positive macroeconomic effects that you get from reduced inequality and a strong middle class. So it's just, I mean, even if you only cared about economics, you should care about inequality. But it's also, it gets yet more complicated. So there's this really interesting report that was put out of Cambridge earlier this year that used this enormous data set for a whole bunch of different countries. And it suggests that there is a link between inequality and erosion of democracy. And that, of course, links to everything that we do. I mean, that has to do with social cohesion and the very ability of governments to function. And of course, to bring in the kind of legislation and other policies that are required to solve other systemic risks. So one of my favorite examples is, you know, if you don't take inequality into account, you can't get climate change legislation done. So, you know, we all know about the Gilets jaunes and the reaction to an attempt at carbon pricing on the part of the French government. Very few people know about the kind of positive examples of the same sorts of policies being implemented successfully elsewhere. So in British Columbia, in my home country of Canada, they implemented a carbon tax something like a dozen years ago. But it was a carbon dividend in that they would return the proceeds from the tax to the people. And it arrived in their bank account very saliently. So you could see that you were getting money back from this dividend. And it was proportionally given to people lower down the income scale. So the less your income, the greater your take from the carbon dividend. And the, you know, the support for that policy actually increased after it was implemented. And it, you know, it's been successful. It's not enough. Let me just say that you need much more than a carbon tax that won't get us to the kind of improvements in infrastructure that we need. But it's certainly one example of how if you don't take inequality into account, you can't get sensible policy in other areas in some cases. The other implication for, you know, that takes into account not just inequality in terms of finances, but also kind of intergenerational inequality is the role of housing. So, you know, it's quite interesting if you see the effects of quantitative easing, for example, in the wake of the 2008-2009 financial crisis. The QE that happened, it was monetary policy that drove it, as opposed to this time around, we've seen much more fiscal intervention. You saw that the increase in the value an inflation of the value of financial assets and housing relative to everything else. So that meant that people who already owned those assets disproportionately benefited. So you actually saw that kind of policy increase inequality fairly dramatically in some cases. And this inflation of financial assets and housing prices was actually not really picked up in the usual measures of inflation. So you're not actually capturing how the average person is falling behind, because, you know, it's all well and good if your groceries cost approximately what you would expect, but if you can't afford to buy a house, that's a real problem. Now, as I was saying, that's an intergenerational issue too, because people in my generation, for example, can't afford a house unless they have family funds to help. It's a real issue, and that actually links into how much you save to retire, you know, in terms of pensions and so on and so forth, because a lot of people rely on the equity that they have in a house. And if you're renting for your whole life, you need to proportionally save more. That's unlikely, because mortgages are actually kind of a forced saving mechanism, among other things. That's a kind of an additional financial risk for the whole system, to have you know, whole generations of people that can't get onto the housing ladder, or who bought into the rising stock market later than the kind of baby boomers who had those assets that were, whose prices were inflated. So it's a really interlinked issue, but it's one that we kind of can't solve without dealing with inequality. And, you know, again, inequality exacerbates a lot of other issues that we need to deal with. But we also, you know, can't deal with those issues without addressing inequality at the same time. So it's really one of those cross-cutting issues.
And something else that sort of ties in with inequality are the environmental impacts, because you've got younger generations that will be dealing with the consequences of climate change for much longer. And we've seen very young people engaging with these topics, with the school strikes for climate, also disproportionately impacted through things like levels of pollution and development of young children, because pollution impacts lots of life systems for human beings. And I guess the other angle from an intergenerational space is the demographic shift that we're seeing from to an aging population. So we're seeing a much higher proportion of people over 65 versus those still in work. And that sort of leads to different patterns of consumption. Older people tend to spend less than younger people, which sort of has that macroeconomic drag that you were talking about before. And there are higher demands on health and care services. So you have all of this going on at the same time when you have a smaller working population available to provide the goods and services that those people need to consume. I was hoping to come back to the SDGs, because we've touched indirectly on quite a few of the SDGs. So we've had sort of decent work and economic growth, which is goal 8, and reduced inequalities, which is goal 10, and climate action, which is goal 13. But I think you'd probably agree that the SDGs should get broad-based support from universal owners. So could you perhaps touch on this?
Universal ownership is really helpful as a basis for the SDGs for a number of reasons, but it's basically because anything that is good for people and the world in general is in a universal owner's interest. So, I mean, I'll just take a couple of kind of random examples, but let's say that you think that it's good to educate girls. I certainly think it is. But that actually has a whole bunch of other positive effects. I mean, the countries in which girls are currently uneducated can then benefit from having, you know, another half the workforce coming to the market with skills and things to contribute. And that actually arguably was a reason for the major economic boom following World War II, because women came into the workforce in large numbers for the first time. And a lot of people claim that that's how we ended up with this kind of golden age of capitalism. But you also end up, that's one of the best things you can do in terms of mitigating climate change as well, is to educate girls, because it tends to space out generations and decrease the number of children per woman, and besides being just kind of the right thing to do. So a lot of these things are interconnected, but you can look at them from this kind of systemic standpoint if you're a universal owner. And just to give another example that's COVID related, we have basically made it inevitable that we would have something like COVID because of our encroachment on the natural world. So we've been warned for a long time that our deforestation of and kind of shrinking of biomes for certain animal species has made it, and our close contact with domesticated animals made it essentially inevitable that we would end up with an increase in zoonotic diseases. So those are diseases that we get from animals. So you can worry about and care about biodiversity, and if you do something about it, you can then also improve and protect human health on a kind of grand scale. And that's besides the all other benefits that biodiversity gives us as humans. So you could even think about pollination. A lot of our food relies on pollination, and so on and so forth. So if you look at the SDGs in the round, you see a lot of interconnectedness among them. And, you know, these things cross borders. I think what's important to keep in mind here is that national governments that are responsible for a lot of the policy that we need to achieve these goals kind of need to be supported, in that they're dealing with issues that cross borders. And the issues that cross borders include carbon emissions, air and water pollution, and large multinational companies and finance. So if you want to have sensible country-level legislation, it kind of makes sense to have support from universal owners so that you don't get kind of a race to the bottom with companies thinking, well, I'll just move to this country where there aren't the same standards. If they are owned by people who expect those same standards, regardless of the geography, then you're less likely to see countries bringing in legislation that would kind of undercut action that we would want to see according to the SDGs. And by the way, that's a benefit for the companies too, because it means that if they wanted to act on some of these SDGs, they wouldn't be at a disadvantage relative to their peers. So it's really quite elegant once you think there is this. It's basically a way of solving a massive collective action problem that has that very fundamental challenge, because it does cross borders and boundaries.
And they are supported very broadly as well. The SDGs are sort of an agreed consensus for things that many countries should pursue. I'd like to move on to the topic of COVID-19, because I know you've been thinking about universal ownership in a COVID-19 era. And I guess you sort of highlight the link between climate change and biodiversity loss, which then contribute to pandemic risk. So I was just wondering if you could outline how those two things interact, because it might be something that's a bit less familiar to our listeners.
So yeah, no, that's a great question. Yes, and it is really, I already outlined some of the links between biodiversity loss and pandemic risk, but you really do need to kind of back up and talk about how climate change is contributing to all of that. And it does that in a number of ways, and I'll just explain a couple. One is that as you see temperatures increase, you see populations of animals and plants, change their geographical zone in which they can live. And that happens in a number of ways. But I mean, for example, I'm from Saskatchewan in Canada, and we used to not have Lyme disease, but ticks now can survive the winter in the southern part of the province. And so we're starting to see Lyme disease for the first time. But you see that with all sorts of species and the species that other species eat, and changes in seasonal variation, the length of seasons and so on and so forth, that affect where animals and plants and insects can live. And that obviously means that certain populations of animals are going to come in contact with humans in a different way, or be desperate and come into human settlements when they wouldn't formerly have done so. But you also see things like there are certain pathogens that thrive in warmer temperatures. So one of the really scary things about climate change is malaria. So this is something I frequently point to the flaws of, but the Gates Foundation has often focused on preventing the spread of malaria by distributing nets and so on and so forth. And historically, they've not really had any focus on climate change. But the funny thing is, if you really want to prevent malaria spread, then you should address climate change, because you could put all the nets up in the world, but the spread of malaria due to increases in global average temperatures is slated to just vastly outstrip any ability to mitigate you could do at the mosquito net level. So malaria will be able to thrive in way more geographical regions, so the mosquitoes that carry them will be able to live in a lot more geographical reasons, and kind of bring that risk to a larger group of people than was previously the case. So those are just examples. There are a lot more, and there are a lot more risks that are slated to come out of our encroachment on the environment in combination with climate change and the other kind of effects that has on animal movements and seasons and so on and so forth. So it's really quite scary, because some of those risks are nonlinear and difficult to predict in their precise nature. But I mean, if you look at the warnings that we had prior to COVID-19, I was looking at a report from November 2019 saying this is inevitable. There will be a pandemic. Here are some things we could do to prevent it. It would cost $1.4 billion or so per year to prevent this. We didn't do it. and now we've spent trillions. And that's the sort of thing that we're looking at. And climate change will simply increase this risk, which is just really scary.
And I'd like to finish the episode with discussing how we recover from this crisis and the types of actions we need to transition ourselves to a low carbon, sustainable economy. And in your recent work, you've talked about a fiscal stimulus as an opportunity to address some of these systemic risks. So could I just get you to cover that?
Sure. So the fiscal stimulus is an unusual opportunity. And let's be clear, there will be a lot more fiscal stimulus after this round, because we're not out of the woods yet. But also there'll be a lot of recovery funds that will be needed even once we can all go back to work and so on as normal. And if you think about it, that means we're going to be building a disproportionate amount of infrastructure and other things that will last a really long time. So we do really need to get it right and use the stimulus to prevent future crises from costing us. And, you know, there are a lot of people, I think, dispute the scale of the fiscal stimulus or think that we're being fiscally irresponsible, but the true fiscal irresponsibility would be to spend in such a way that we actually seeded future costly systemic risks to manifest themselves. And this is what actually fascinates me about actuaries and the role that you can play, because there are very few other professions in which you routinely think about the long term and about life cycles and life phases and the generations or cohorts. And you just think a lot more long term than most people do. And I think that, you know, there's a role that you can play in terms of how this next tranche of fiscal stimulus gets spent. There's a lot of talk about building back better and so on and so forth, but governments clearly need a lot more pressure to ensure that that actually happens, because I think we've seen relatively disappointing results. And especially once it gets to the point at which people can safely leave their homes and build new infrastructure. I mean, right now we're in maintenance mode, right? But when we can finally get recovery funds, once the pandemic is sort of under control and can start to build out the infrastructure that we need to prevent future crises, we need that to be spent really strategically. And I think that you and your roles as actuaries can quite usefully lead the charge on that, because you are thinking so long term and that is so unusual.
And it's sort of a opportunity, but there's also a risk there that you're locking in something. And the sort of classic example I always think of is road networks and the internal combustion engine. So you've got lots of infrastructure related to roads and cars, when actually you wouldn't want to invest in road building as part of Build Back Better. You'd want to invest in things like public transport and electrical charging infrastructure and that sort of thing to lock in the new generation of technology which transitions us to that low carbon economy.
Good point, Lucy. And actually, just to build on that slightly, there are known sources of lock-in to fossil fuel infrastructure that we can avoid in this transition. One of them, as you say, is road networks and anything related to the internal combustion engine. That's one of the top three. And the other two, somewhat unsurprisingly, are coal-powered plants and gas-powered plants. And a lot of people see gas as a kind of bridge fuel. Having now done a lot of research on this, I don't see it that way. I think we need to make sure that we aren't building large-scale infrastructure that that will then have an incentive to keep running well past when it makes sense. And actually, an important thing to mention here is that in all major markets, new renewables are more cost-effective than new coal infrastructure, and that's rapidly becoming the case for gas too. And we're going to reach the point relatively soon at which, in all major markets, old coal can't compete with new renewables, which is wild. But this is the situation we're in now. We should make use of this pricing advantage that's only just come into play very recently. But this is, it's just luck that we have advantageous pricing in this moment in which we're going to be spending so much money.
And I guess the other thing we should probably pick up on is the human aspect of that. So the just transition rather than just a transition. So actually thinking about retraining, re-educating, good green jobs that people can take, and actually thinking about how you run down the old industries, but in a way that is fair to the people that work in them.
Yeah, that is such a huge concern for a number of reasons. I mean, I'm from the province of Saskatchewan in Canada has the highest per capita emissions, and part of that is because of industry, including oil and gas and coal. And a lot of the people I grew up with, are linked in some way to those industries, either directly or not. So I really worry about that. But I also think it affects political acceptability. So if you want to be able to get where we need to go, we have to take care of communities and workers who need retraining and good jobs. That's the thing. I mean, a lot of these kind of legacy industries actually pay quite well for people who aren't highly educated, in universities. So a lot of trades and so on, some of which don't have easy transferable skills for the new industries, but some of which could be adjusted. Geothermal is a really good thing to work on if you have some of the skills that you would be using in an oil and gas company, for example. But I think we actually are morally obligated, but also just practically required to work out a just transition. It's not going to work otherwise.
I'd just like to touch on as well is difference between standard responsible investment practices and the different lens that universal ownership brings. Because I think that's really interesting and it's important. And I'm not sure it's something that I would necessarily have been aware of before reading your work.
Thanks, Lucy. Yeah, it's a huge issue because ESG, or environmental, social, and governance investing, or responsible investment, whichever you want to call it, has really taken off. And actually, even in the pandemic, we've seen it really take off. But there's a really fundamental flaw here in that most ESG, or responsible investment, is built around the idea that you want to protect your own portfolio from climate risk or from these various social environmental risks. And that doesn't map on to actually reducing those risks in the real world. So I'll give you some color on that. So first of all, it really depends on which asset class you're looking at if you want to have an impact as opposed to protect your portfolio. So, if you're looking at public equity, when you buy or sell shares, you're buying and selling between and among other shareholders, right? The money that you spend on buying a share doesn't go to the company, it goes to another shareholder. So it doesn't actually affect the company when you buy or sell shares, with the exception of, if you're a respected institution and you make a big divestment announcement, then you're kind of shaming those companies and that can have a social discourse effect. So I'm not talking about that. But if you don't announce it and you're just buying and selling shares, there's really little to no impact on the company. But you could avoid some risks, such as, stranded assets or whatever. However, if you want to actually have an effect on the real world and the extent to which you are mitigating these systemic risks, you need to look at other asset classes. So, about 90% of new capital that goes into fossil fuels comes from debt. So, a majority comes from bank lending, so bank loans to fossil fuel companies or projects. And a decent chunk also comes from bonds. And it's kind of interesting, right? If you own a share in a company, you might also own the very same company's bonds. And the thing is that that company might come to the market a couple of times a year to raise more capital. And that new money goes to new things. that's a serious issue if you don't want to encourage a company to build out new infrastructure that gets locked in, like a new coal-fired power plant, for example. So that's really how you need to think about things is, if you want to have an impact on the real world, you need to look at asset classes other than public equity, and maybe even especially debt, but private equity and venture capital also can play a big role. And if you're just narrowly trying to protect your own portfolio, which by the way really doesn't work in the long term, you can't stock pick your way out of climate change and so on. Then you look at public equity. So that's, I think, a really important flipping around of the paradigm. You know, ESG and RI tends to be focused on public equity. So if you look at your pension fund, or let's say you're buying into a new fund and they've got some fancy screen, but then you look at it and you find that it's all public equity, that's not legitimate unless they have some extremely compelling shareholder engagement proposition. And even there, I did a lot of research on shareholder engagement as well, and it's really hard to do an effective job of that as well. You need to really be doing things like voting against board of directors. You need to be, asking for actual outcomes as opposed to means like disclosure only. You'd be actually getting them to decrease their real world emissions or changing their CapEx plans. It's very difficult to do that level of engagement. In the meantime, I would argue you should not be providing them new capital through bonds. One thing to highlight here is it really shows you how important banks are. So there are probably 2 to 3 dozen major global banks, the names of which you would probably likely know, that are providing a majority of new financing to fossil fuels alone. And that is just a very strange situation to have such a small number of actors that are disproportionately contributing to this issue. And as Lucy's pointed out before, these are backed up by taxpayers. These tend to be banks that are too big to fail. And they also underwrite bonds as well. So if you look at the debt picture, which is again about 90% of the source of new capital, it's all about banks because they account for the lending and the underwriting of new bond issues as well. So I would just really counsel that people look at banks. There are really good reports that look at the lending activities of banks as relates to climate change. And it's just absolutely critical that we get banks to keep their clients. We don't need them to get away from all of their high emitting clients, but they need to put in place the structures, the covenants, the contracts that would allow those clients of the banks to decarbonize as quickly and justly as possible.
Lastly, what I'd like to touch on is just how we implement some of the things that you've touched on today. So, what metrics and targets do we need? How do we measure some of these things?
So I'll start by saying that I think people focus too much on metrics and disclosure and so on and so forth. Not because that's not needed, it is needed, but people tend to just ask for that. And if you're just asking for really good disclosure, you know what you're going to get is maybe you'll get really good disclosure. But from what I've seen, you're quite unlikely to see improvements in actual environmental performance out of that, which is a real problem. So I think that we should be thinking of really good disclosure and reporting and policies and all of that as good means, but we need to be asking for those actual ends or outcomes. So I favor what I've termed ungameable metrics, things that people can't get around. So if we just take a fossil fuel company, for example, what I would want to know about whether or not they are aligning with the Paris Agreement, by the way, none of them is yet, but I would want to see that they are not members of trade associations that are lobbying against sensible climate legislation. I would want to see their CapEx, so their capital expenditure, aligned with the Paris Agreement so that they're not doing, massive exploration in new fields and so on and so forth. And I would want to see production cuts in the fairly short term, actually, and a kind of a wind down plan. I would want to see remuneration metrics that reward people for actually decarbonizing. I would want to see R&D that is aligned with a transition towards renewables and so on and so forth. But I guess that the thing to emphasize there is that you can't just have a 2050 commitment because you can blow through your carbon budget in the meantime. You could blow through it in a few years if you massively continue to massively expand. So it's absolutely critical that you have a sensible trajectory towards 2050 that involves critically, and I just want to emphasize this, it involves production cuts. You know, all of these global oil and gas companies, certainly coal companies, they need to be winding down. They need to be decreasing the production of fossil fuels going out to, you know, the next few years. And by 2050, you know, it needs to be almost entirely phased out. So I think that if we look at metrics that some of these companies tend to emphasize, they look a lot at, you know, energy intensity targets and so on and so forth. Those could accompany an overall increase in emissions, because all you have to do is produce more of these fossil fuels, even if the per unit energy intensity drops. And the other thing is, you can spend all you want on renewables, but the addition of carbon dioxide equivalents into the atmosphere means that if you continue to burn fossil fuels, it doesn't matter how much alternative energy you produce. We need to get to absolute zero. So there does need to be management of the decline of fossil fuel production and use. And that's why I actually think we need, and this is circulating more and more these days, I think we need a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty to manage that down. Because there are some really interesting papers on this. I can share one of them with you, Lucy, that look at the macroeconomic effects of decarbonization. And you can actually see what we started to see earlier this year, which is a price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia that brought down dramatically the price of oil, for example, which could end up increasing the consumption of oil and kind of delaying the adoption of other technologies that can't compete with a very, very low oil price. But it also causes financial issues for countries like Saudi Arabia, Russia, Canada, etc., when the price goes so low. So if we manage that decline and have a kind of an allocation by country as to how much they can produce, then it actually works out better economically as well as carbon-wise.
Thanks, Ellen. Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of what has been a really interesting conversation. Just to recap for our listeners, universal ownership is really relevant to the institutions with long-term outlooks and well-diversified portfolios such that they hold a representative slice of the overall economy. And this really leads us to think about systemic risks that will show up as costs across that portfolio. So we're talking about insurance companies, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, large asset owners. These are characteristics that I think a lot of the actuaries listening will recognise in the institutions that they work for. So thank you for what has been a really interesting subject. And for our listeners, if you want to read Ellen's papers and find out more about universal ownership, then I will link both of those in the show notes.